This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, June 9th, 2004. I'm Nell Abram. The lawyer in charge of the group that sent a memo to President Bush advising him that torture of Al-Qaeda detainees may be legal is also a White House judicial nominee. The G8 summit begins with talk of President Bush's broader Middle East initiative. We'll get reaction. Conflict quiets in the Congo, but observers remain concerned that the peace process may be in peril. And a new report from Clear the Air that says power plant pollution causes more deaths than drunk drivers or homicides. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Kurds in Iraq are unhappy with the just-signed government deal and are concerned the progress they have made over the past decade will be lost. They are now insisting on clearly stated autonomy, or they say they will withdraw from the newly formed government. In Turkey, a court ordered the release of four Kurdish political prisoners. Leyla Zana and three colleagues will likely get a new trial and may be released from prison today. The Turkish government has long fought Kurds seeking independence. However, European Union membership, in part, rests on the Turkish government's ability to advance human rights in the country that has restricted language and cultural rights for the nation's 12 million Kurds. In New York, 7,000 teachers, attendants, and directors at as many as 350 daycare centers are staging a walkout to press for a new contract with retroactive raises. Amabuadi reports from WBAI.
New York City daycare workers have been working without a contract since April 2000. The members of District Council 1707 say they have not had a pay rise since December 2000. They are seeking retroactive pay rises in line with what city workers received in 2001, a 9% increase over 27 months. While the daycare workers understand that their strike will affect 50,000 children and their parents, who are mostly from low-income families, one member of the union said today that she is struggling to make ends meet for her own family on a $20,000 a year salary. In April, the union local representatives rejected the city administration's offer of a pay increase or one-time payment to daycare workers, but not the supervisors. Protesters are pessimistic that they will be able to force the administration to increase their pay. Union leaders say the strike will continue until a satisfactory deal has been agreed. For Free Speech Radio News in New York City, I'm Amma Bouadi.
Picket lines may keep other union workers from finishing their jobs at the Boston Convention Center, scheduled to host the Democrats this summer. Chuck Rosina reports from Boston.
The Boston Police Patrolmen's Association set up a picket line to protest the lack of a contract between their union and the city of Boston. Union construction workers refused to cross the picket line to begin their work. The Boston school bus drivers, who are part of the United Steelworkers of America, are one of the city's most outspoken locals. They too are working without a contract and organized a rally outside the Greater Boston Labor Council meeting. Jerry Scopitalo of the AFL-CIO Pride at Work addressed that rally.
If Mayor Menino and the Democratic National Convention can find hundreds of millions of dollars to entertain rich lobbyists next month, then they can find the money to pay the school bus drivers for making sure that our children get to schools and that they get to desegregated schools safely.
Union officials said they expect firefighters and members of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers to join the picket line. Boston Mayor Thomas Menino says he would not bow to such public pressure and insisted that negotiations should go to binding arbitration. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Chuck Rosina in Boston.
Hezbollah fighters and the Israeli military continue to exchange gunfire in southern Lebanon, despite criticism from Lebanese diplomats at the United Nations. Mohammed Shublak reports from Beirut.
Tension rose on the Lebanese-Israeli borders as guerrillas of the Islamic organization Hezbollah and the Israeli army engaged in heavy clashes yesterday. The fight took place after unknown fighters launched a rocket attack at an Israeli gunship last Monday. The Israeli army retaliated by raiding a Palestinian organization based near Beirut. Both Lebanon and Israel sent complaints to the UN Security Council, blaming each other for the new wave of violence. UN officers described the retaliations as a serious and worrisome wave of reactions that carry the potential for escalation. Clashes between Hezbollah and Israeli army have been frequent as the Lebanese government keeps the national army away from the conflict. For FSRN, this is Mohammed Chublak, Beirut, Lebanon.
The Organization of American States General Assembly agreed to call for immediate elections in Haiti over objections from representatives of the United States. Leaders meeting in Ecuador also called for an assessment of the situation after Bush administration officials fought a full-scale investigation. President Jean-Bertrand Aristide insists U.S. officials kidnapped him and installed their own choice to run the country. The OAS statement invoked Article 20, which permits the body to assess a situation in another country in the event of unconstitutional alterations of the constitutional regime that seriously impairs the democratic order. U.S. diplomats attempted to argue that Aristide stepped down in a constitutional manner and the existing U.S.-installed leadership is constitutional. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The Wall Street Journal reported on Monday that the Pentagon's top civilian lawyer, William Haynes, is the person who was responsible for a team of lawyers that created a memo suggesting that President Bush did not have to abide by international and domestic anti-torture laws when security is at risk. William Haynes is also President Bush's judicial nominee for the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Virginia, which commonly hears anti-terrorism cases. And Mitch Jezrich reports from Capitol Hill that U.S. lawyers representing abused Iraqi detainees filed lawsuits today against private contractors that allegedly provided interrogative services at Iraqi prisons.
A class action lawsuit filed on Wednesday by the Center for Constitutional Rights and others charges two U.S. corporations of conspiring with U.S. officials in the abuse of Iraqi detainees. The two companies, the Titan Corporation in San Diego and Khaki International in Virginia, have provided contract services for the U.S. in Iraqi prisons. Susan Burke with the law firm Montgomery, McCracken, Walker & Rhodes says both Titan and Khaki engaged in torture so to boost their profits.
In order to ensure that they were perceived as effective interrogators, they entered into a conspiracy with certain U.S. government officials. And the conspiracy is one in which they decided to ignore and violate the host of international and domestic laws in order to meet quotas and to constantly crank out more information from the detainees. They simply violated their human rights. The conspiracy was successful in the sense that their profits grew. Compared to the same quarter last year, Khaki's increased 29% and Titan's increased 21%.
Neither Khaki or Titan returned phone calls before airtime. However, Titan has reportedly said that its contractors were linguists who did not participate in torture. This comes just a day after Attorney General John Ashcroft refused Democratic lawmakers' request to hand over three memos leaked through the press suggesting that the Justice Department and the Pentagon advised the White House that it was not bound by torture laws. The Wall Street Journal reported that one memo indicates that Pentagon civilian lawyers overruled its own military lawyers to say President Bush was immune to such laws because of national security. And the head of the Pentagon civilian lawyers is Counsel William Haynes, who has defended the military's treatment of detainees at Guantanamo Bay and who also happens to be President Bush's judicial nominee for the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. Because the Fourth Circuit is located in Virginia, most anti-terrorism and detainment cases are heard there. Elisa Massimino is with Human Rights First.
It's troubling. Like Haynes is being put forward for a lifetime appointment to the federal bench when it now appears that he was not completely forthcoming in specific communications with members of the Senate Judiciary Committee about this very issue of torture.
However, Senate confirmation of Haynes' appointment is uncertain, especially in light of the prison abuse scandal. Haynes' name was included in a list of controversial judicial nominees that President Bush promised not to give a recess appointment to, in return for the Democrats' promise not to filibuster the non-controversial nominees. Democratic Senator Richard Durbin represents Illinois.
Mr. Haynes is on a list of controversial nominees because he's refused to answer questions from Senator Kennedy and myself about his role as general counsel for the Pentagon, particularly as it related to the interrogation of prisoners. As far as I'm concerned, I'll do everything I can to stop a vote on Mr. Haynes until he answers these questions.
Durbin, along with other Democrats, are calling for the Senate Judiciary Committee to hold Attorney General Ashcroft in contempt for refusing to provide to the committee internal Justice Department memos concerning torture. John Ashcroft.
We are at war. And for us to begin to discuss all the legal ramifications of the war is not in our best interest, and it has never been in times of war.
Holding Ashcroft in contempt would require the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Orrin Hatch, to go along with it, but Hatch says he doesn't support it.
Ashcroft has a very tough job. He's counsel to the president and attorney general for the whole United States, and I can see why legal opinions to the president ought to be kept confidential, or otherwise you squelch the opportunity to have honest legal opinions.
Ashcroft mentioned that because we're at a time of war that we can't be as open as we normally do. However, we don't know when the end of this war will even see it. How can we reconcile open government and maybe an indefinite war? Maybe people shouldn't expect as an open government as we once had?
You know, we're still the most open government in the world, and to the extent that we can keep it even more open, that's great. But there are certain elements of terrorism here that we have to not be stupid about.
Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
President Bush today called on NATO allies to help with security in Iraq, even though Germany and France have refused to send troops to the region. Interim Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Alawi said the country will need foreign troops to fight guerrillas even after the U.S.-led occupation formally ends on June 30th. Kurdish security forces, which are not overseen by the U.S.-led occupation authority, have managed to keep peace in the three governorates they control. But as Dave Enders and Salam Tlaib report from Baghdad, Iraqi police say U.S. forces have complicated their efforts.
Iraqi police are looking forward to losing what many of them consider a monkey on their back, the oversight of the U.S. military, which has been training as well as loosely monitoring the 8,000-strong police force that went back to work in the city in May of last year. Police and U.S. forces are now working on a governorate-by-governorate basis to restore control to the Iraqi police in anticipation of the June 30th transfer of some sovereignty to Iraqis. Bassem Mahmoud Hamid, the chief police spokesman in the country, says the U.S. military has often undermined police operations.
Since last May 2003, they arrested hundreds or thousands of criminals. I mean, not regular criminals, carjackers, thieves, burglars. They put them in the jail. Then, you know, the normal problems between the coalition and the police officers, that Lieutenant X or Captain Y, he came to the station and released all the detainees. So this activity or this action by the coalition forces, this encouraged the police officers to arrest more and more criminals. I mean, for example, I'm a police officer. If I arrest a criminal on 6 o'clock, then at 8 o'clock, one of the military came to release him. And because of the nature of our society and tribal revenge and something like that, this issue forced me to stop arrest any person more and more. But after 13th of July, this authority will be taken from the coalition. They will not have the authority to release any detainee unless they have to obey the permission, or they have to have the permission from the judge.
More than 80 police officers have been killed in the last 2 months, and U.S. military operations have made police targets for attacks. During armed uprisings against the U.S. military across the country in the past 2 months, militia groups have made taking over police stations a top priority. But Bassem says worse violence could ensue if U.S. forces continue to have control.
They will commit the biggest mistake in their life if they didn't let the Iraqis control the security situation.
Al Karma Police Station is one of the two main police stations in Sadr City, the sprawling North Baghdad slum where rebel cleric Muqtada al-Sadr draws most of the support for his Mehdi militia. 3 days ago, the police were told to leave the station. Shortly after they left it, it was attacked by residents of the neighborhood, who cleared the area and then dynamited it, killing two officers. Sheikh Abdul Jabbar is the leader of one of the Mehdi militia units in the neighborhood.
8 days ago, the Americans came to arrest some people, and then they came to put some snipers on the roof. They shot more than 10 civilians, people going to the market, people coming from work. They used the tanks and small guns to destroy some of the power substations and some of the generators in the neighborhood for no reason. For 5 days, the market was not open. There was no water, no electricity, no school, no examinations. It was not the Mehdi army that led this attack. It was the people. It's the second time the Americans came to this police station, and they have used the police station and the fact it is surrounded by houses and markets for protection. We don't mind if the police are keeping security over here. We cooperate with them. Everyone cooperates with them. But we do not like the Americans to use this police station.
Fighting between U.S. troops and the Mehdi militia takes place almost nightly in Sadr City, and as dusk fell this evening, Mehdi militia members were preparing for another U.S. assault. In Baghdad, this is David Enders reporting with Salem Talib for Free Speech Radio News.
Today marks the first day of formal talks between leaders of the world's most powerful nations at the G8 summit on Sea Island, Georgia. Pushing other important environmental and health issues aside, President Bush is using the occasion as an opportunity to push his agenda dubbed the Broader Middle East Initiative, focusing on so-called stability and progress in the region. Meanwhile, activists have been converging all week in the town of Brunswick. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Ora Bogado files this report from Sea Island and from Brunswick.
Many countries being discussed in Bush's broader Middle East strategy were not invited to Sea Island or, as in the case of Egypt and Tunisia, declined the offer to attend. Dan Freed is a senior U.S. administration official. He confirms that President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair discussed Bush's initiative at a breakfast meeting and little else.
Yesterday's success on Iraq sets the stage for movement and adoption of the broader Middle East initiative by the G8 leaders. And today's events also include an outreach session from leaders of the region and also the Prime Minister of Turkey. President and Prime Minister discussed the broader Middle East initiative. They also discussed Israel-Palestine issues and discussed ways in which progress could be made. They grappled with some of the problems, talked about possible ways forward.
But some of those ways forward could get murky. Bush is looking for a uniform final communique on the Middle East from all leaders, a goal that all G8 countries, which include Japan, Russia, Italy, France, Germany, the UK, and Canada, may not agree upon. Jito Okuyama is the assistant press secretary for the Japanese Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He says that the issues of ownership and diversity are key in the Middle East and added that Israel needs to practice self-control in order for any real progress to be made in Palestine.
We fully agree with the opinion from some quarters that the ownership and diversity should not be used as a pretext for doing nothing at all. But at the same time, through our own experience of development, we believe that ownership and diversity are two important elements. On the recent incidents that are taking place in Palestine, we would like to call for maximum self-restraint on the part of the Israeli government in their military operations.
As world leaders gather on Plush Sea Island, the nearby town of Brunswick has seen more activity from local, state, and federal police than from demonstrators against the G8. The state of Georgia received $25 million in federal money to create a virtual police state, issuing a statewide state of emergency over a month before the G8 began. Lisa Fithian is the national co-chair for United for Peace and Justice. She says that oppressive authorities are using the small town as a practice base for future urban warfare-style operations.
It's just really become clear that this is a training ground for the new Homeland Security Department to practice how to occupy domestic soil. There are over 20,000 law enforcement and military people in the community of Brunswick, a literal military occupation. And in a community of 15,000 people, I think it's a terrible tragedy for what's happening in the United States.
Nevertheless, activists continue to attend rallies, marches, and alternative forums, all under the watchful eye of the military and the police. Reporting from the Independent Media Center in Brunswick, Georgia, I'm Aura Bogado for Free Speech Radio News.
Pollution from power plants caused more deaths in America than either drunk driving or homicide. That's according to a first-of-its-kind report released by a national education campaign for clean air. The largest power plants in the country operate in and around Houston, Texas. Erica McDonald takes us there for this report.
For the first time ever, information about death caused by power plant emissions on a plant-by-plant basis is available to the public online in a user-friendly format. Clear the Air, a nationwide education campaign, today uploaded the findings of their report, Dirty Air, Dirty Power. It's the first report to connect pollution-related deaths to specific power plants across the nation. Texas Public Interest Research Group's Luke Metzger, a member of the campaign, describes the report.
We took EPA emissions data that's available, and then we used their own consulting firm, used their own methodology to, for the first time, calculate what are the health impacts from, for instance, heart attacks and lung cancer deaths, premature deaths, plant by plant, city by city, all across the country.
Dirty Air, Dirty Power revealed that in 1 year, nearly 24,000 lives were cut short by power plant pollution. 2,800 of those deaths were from lung cancer. Industry emissions also caused 38,200 heart attacks. These numbers are based on the most recent available data from the Environmental Protection Agency in 2002. The report studied the most dangerous chemicals emitted from U.S. power plants, including mercury, ozone, carbon dioxide, and nitrogen oxides. But when it comes to lung and heart function, the most deadly pollutant is fine particulate matter. A researcher with the Baylor College of Medicine's Environmental Health Department, Rebecca Jensen, explains the more recent scientific findings that link the pollutant to heart problems.
Researchers, scientists have found that fine particulate matter, it gets inhaled deep into the lung, and so when the particles are absorbed deep into the lung, they're then passed over into the bloodstream, which then affects the chemistry and then in turn causes some inflammation, which ultimately can lead to variability in the heart rate and heart function and premature death.
Those most likely to die from pollution-related health effects, the study found, were the elderly and children. Jane Laping is the executive director for Mothers for Clean Air. The Houston-based group counsels mothers on how to protect their children from the city's deadly smog. But Laping says the best protection is prevention. That's why her group supports cleaning up pollution at its source.
There are nearly a million children in Harris County alone who are at risk of health effects from air pollution. And we hear from moms who check air pollution warnings and don't allow their kids outside when air pollution levels are high. And we need to be attacking the pollution problem from all levels, and certainly power plants is an easy way that we can regulate through the federal government to reduce air pollution levels in the Houston area.
But changing federal law seems to be going the other direction. Dirty Power, Dirty Air compares the Bush administration's Clear Skies initiative to find that more than 4,000 lives would be saved just by enforcing existing law. Instead, with its initiative stalled in Congress, the administration has used the regulatory process to ease restrictions on deadly power plant emissions. Again, Texas Public Interest Research Group's Luke Metzger.
It's startling to see an administration disregard science, the law, and our children's health in order to satisfy big campaign contributors. And since taking office, the Bush administration has reversed its campaign pledge to support a mandatory cap on power plant emissions of carbon dioxide. They've broken a decades-old promise codified in the Clean Air Act that old coal-fired power plants would install modern pollution controls and making changes that increase emissions, and proposed legislation and regulatory rollbacks that would significantly extend deadlines for healthier air and weaken goals for reducing soot-forming sulfur dioxide, smog-forming nitrogen oxide, and toxic mercury emissions from power plants.
A bipartisan bill sponsored by Vermont Senator Jim Jeffords, an independent, would reduce the amount of time given by the Bush administration for polluting plants to clean up. According to today's report, the Jeffords plan would save 100,000 more lives than the Clear Skies Initiative by the year 2020. From KPFT in Houston, Texas, I'm Erica McDonald for Free Speech Radio News.
The eastern Congo city of Bukavu is under control of the government today after the last dissident forces fled during the night. More than 2,000 refugees sought shelter in Rwanda after fighting broke out late last month, and relief organizations have scaled back their work in the region. There's been anxiety among regional observers and aid agencies that the rebels' week-long takeover of the strategic city could mark the unraveling of the Central African country's peace process. The transitional government under President Joseph Kabila took power last June after a five-year war that left dead an estimated 3.3 million people, many of them through disease and famine. Many in the DRC still live in abject poverty. Rupert Cook reports that with the breakdown of infrastructure and the massive social displacement caused by the conflict, the number of street children has risen dramatically.
Solange is 15.
Until very recently, she used to scrape a living through begging on the streets of Goma, a town in the east of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Here she's describing what life on the streets was like, how she almost always went hungry, how she and the other street children were regularly at risk of harassment from local armed militias. Solange lost her parents in the early years of Congo's decade of civil strife. She went to live with her uncle, only for him to die shortly afterwards. In a country with virtually no social services, the loss of Solange's immediate relatives proved devastating, and she ended up on the streets. Solange's story is similar to that of thousands of other Congolese children, especially in the east of the country, a region particularly hard hit by the conflict. Bernard Kitimbala is a child protection officer with Congolese NGO, SEGAD.
Apart from the fact that some parents can die from sickness, we have also the conflict. And many people died from that conflict, and now children, we have many orphans. So you can have street children, and nobody is taking care of those children. The second factor is also HIV. As a disease, it has killed many people. Another factor is that children have no support, parents are not getting money. So the crisis has been so strong that now children prefer to go to the street in order to earn their lives. This is one of the main and major factors of having street children in DRC, particularly in the east.
With tensions rising in eastern Congo and increased anxiety about the durability of the current peace process, the situation for Congo's street children remains precarious. A resumption of open conflict could be catastrophic, with yet more children forced onto the streets. Johannes Wedenig is the UNICEF representative for eastern Congo.
Well, basically the link is, first of all, of course, the poverty, which is increased because of the conflict, because of the disruption of the economic activities, and so the income power of families that have dropped dramatically. Secondly, there's massive population displacements, particularly in the east. So you have many families that are displaced. Sometimes you have children that are separated from their families. But also you have families that are simply falling into poverty because of displacements. Then, of course, you have families that are disrupted, partly also as a consequence of the war. And all of that is, of course, a pool of children that has no longer a home that can support them, or that has no home at all. And those, you will find them in the streets. So there's certainly a link between the conflict and the phenomenon of street children.
Solange is in fact one of a fortunate few, in that she no longer has to live on the streets. A few months ago, a local Congolese NGO gave her a place to stay in a centre specialising in the rehabilitation of street children. But for tens of thousands of other Congolese children, their only option remains a very hard life on the streets of Congo's towns and cities.
La paix universelle, litons pour la paix. La paix en Afrique, nous ne voulons plus la guerre.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rupert Cook in Goma, the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Et l'amour pour trouver la paix que nous cherchons, ta Seigneur sauveur, en pitié.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Nell Abram.